It's time for a more in-depth look at today's news. It's time to find out who's pulling the strings. It's time for the Behind the Curtain podcast with your host, author Jeff Reynolds.
Welcome into lucky episode number 13 of the Behind the Curtain podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds. This week, I talked to two very involved activists who focus a lot of their energy on local politics while maintaining a national perspective. My first guest is mom, activist, writer, and podcaster extraordinaire Kira Davis. My buddy Kira and I go way back to the early days of the Tea Party, blogging, and surviving the Cruiser Cabana days. She recently earned a position as roving editor of Red State, along with co-hosting the Smart Girls Politics podcast with April Gregory. Kira and I talk about her new position at Red State, the state of conservative media, a favorite topic of mine, and her deep dive into the comprehensive sex education curriculum in California and her organizing efforts to fight back. We also poke fun at the 2020 field of Democratic presidential hopefuls just for fun. You can find Kira on Twitter at twitter.com/realkiradavis. Also, be sure to follow her on Red State and subscribe to the Smart Girls Politics podcast. Quick note, again, no bonus segment this week for Patreon, but you really should go check out previous recordings. There's tons of extra info available exclusively for our patrons, which you can find at patreon.com/behindthecurtain with Jeff Reynolds. My local guest this week is John Lee, who lives just over the Columbia River in southwest Washington. John has been following local transportation issues in Oregon and Washington for years and ran for the Washington legislature in 2014. We chat about how insane the transportation policies of our respective states are, how destructive tolling will be for the average commuter, and what they should be doing but refuse to do to solve our regional transportation problems. This was a fun talk that really got into a lot of important detail. You can read more of John's stuff at www.johnlee.us, and Lee is spelled L-E-Y. Don't forget to subscribe to the Behind the Curtain podcast wherever you listen to it, and please leave a positive rating. The more subscribers and the better ratings, the higher Behind the Curtain will rank on podcast services like iTunes and Google Podcasts, among many others. Quick note about my book. I'm currently planning an East Coast trip in the fall to speak to my alma mater, Connecticut College, and their College Republican Club about Behind the Curtain. I'm excited to return after many years and confront the liberal campus culture with real facts about who owns the professional left in America. If you know any conservative clubs, Republican groups, Tea Party or 912 clubs, or anyone else who would get something out of following the dark money on the left, please email me at info@5440fight.com. Search for Behind the Curtain inside the network of progressive billionaires and their campaign to undermine democracy in stores or online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Simon & Schuster. It's available in hardback, Kindle, or Nook now. Check out whoownsthedems.com for more information. Okay, welcome to the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. I'm your host, Jeff Reynolds, and I'm here with my good friend Kira Davis. Kira and I was trying to think about this, Kira. I think we met in 2012 in a Cruiser Cabana in Vegas. Does that sound right to you?
Wow, that's probably about right. That would be right online, I believe.
Yep, exactly, yep. Exactly. And what happens in the Cruiser Cabana stays in the Cruiser Cabana.
That's right. That was my first Cruiser Cabana.
That's so. Right. Yeah, I think I've been to one before at CPAC, and they were so legendary that Cruiser himself had to shut the thing down to avoid legal entanglements, I think.
Good times, though. Good times.
Oh, man. Yeah, we go way back. So Kira is my good buddy. Kira's been a writer on the conservative scene for a long time now. You were with Red State, and then there was a little kerfuffle last year, and now you've been rehired as an editor at large for Red State, and you're also a co-host of the Smart Girl Politics podcast. And Smart Girl is a really cool little outfit. I really enjoy your work there.
Thank you. Yeah, it's cool because just a little grassroots outlet aimed at women in politics, and started by Terry Kristoff and Stacey Mott way back when we first met, and it has stayed grassroots. I mean, we really are just kind of a low-key operation, but it's you know, true to form. It's kind of one of the last vestiges of our Tea Party days. You know, we're not corporate, it's just some ladies that want to get women engaged in politics and provide some interesting conversations. So I remember, you know, going to Smart Girl conferences and going to and reading or listening to Smart Girl podcasts and reading Smart Girl stories over the years back when I started in blogging. So it's really cool to be a Smart Girl now.
Yeah, no, that goes all the way back to, I was just thinking about this at the early days of the Tea Party and things like Ning sites and stuff like that.
Yeah, oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, we've come a long way, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tell me what you're doing now with Red State. You've got a lot of really interesting articles up there now.
Well, I took some time off from Red State. I moved over to Town Hall, which were kind of in the same media family, so it wasn't that drastic of a move.
Yeah.
And did some columnist work. I've been an op-ed journalist for as long as you've known me. That's what I've done. And Red State, as you mentioned earlier, had a little bit of a shake-up. Some things got mixed up. Some new management came over and offered me the title of editor-at-large to come back. And I thought it was the right time to come back, and Red State's kind of beginning to grow again. It started out as a grassroots blog. It's become a conservative staple over the years. Of course, Eric Erickson was the one that started that up, and he's left to do his own things since that time. He sold the outlet. But it's still a very trustworthy site for conservatives. Like your dad probably is on Red State, you know, your mom's on Red State. Like, it's still a known website. It's like the bread and butter. It's like the meat of the conservative blogging world. So it's not as flashy or sexy as like the Daily Wire, obviously, but it's still, you know, it's got its own base and its own community, and it's still picks up a lot of really great traffic. So we're actually looking to push it into a little bit of the new era with some changes and exciting things going on over there.
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting with the Salem Media acquisition of Red State, because I my main outlet is PJ Media, and we just got acquired by Salem as well. And, you know, Red State and PJ Media sort of occupy this unique space on the right where we have a really strong brand, and we really have established our authenticity through the movement and through the years. And so I think it seems to be what Salem is doing. You know, they already had Town Hall, which had their own brand and their own voice and their own authenticity. And then, you know, PJ and Red State are kind of in the same boat.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting to see how the blogosphere has changed since the days of Breitbart. But there is still that base, that, you know, that bread and butter layer of blogging that feeds all of the upper echelons and levels of blogging. And we still have a really big readership. I mean, it's amazing how many people have stuck with Red State over the years.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because blogging, I mean, I just did my last episode last week with Paula Bolliard, my manager over at PJ, and you know, we were talking about the history of blogging and where it's gone and what's happening, you know, with the evolution of conservative media. And blogging, we don't go to these blogging conferences anymore. We don't, you know, try to bring up new voices. So that's kind of a deficit. But blogging is still the backbone of what we do in these professional settings. And it's sort of the melding of like news reporting and analysis and giving the right perspective, the conservative perspective on the news of the day. So it's still, you know, it's not necessarily opinion, but it's also, you know, giving more perspective and more analysis, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. I do think it is opinion. I mean, I think that's important to state. And it's one of the things that Andrew Breitbart did really well. You know, he came out of this world where he recognized that politics is largely cultural, that the two spheres influence each other. And he recognized that the what we now refer to as the mainstream media was really left wing. It was a left wing media, and that they were really opining a lot in their reporting. And his thing was, instead of complaining about how it's unfair, how, you know, let's go out and create our own.
Right.
And so the right wing media industry really has become like opinion journalism. But I think all opinion journalism, that's all journalism is these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's been for a long time.
Absolutely. And you're only going to get, now there are real journalists out there who report just straight stories. Typically they're at the local level. But I always, you know, the best news digging is going on at your local TV station, at your local blog, newspaper.
Yep.
So those are where, you know, the bigger outlets get their stories. Those people are still doing reporting. But for the rest of us, we're really, as you said, Jeff, we're doing the analysis. We're analyzing, we're reporting the news as it breaks, but then we're also offering our own analysis. And I think that's what people appreciate these days. I think people want to, they want help framing an argument. They want help forming a thought. That's probably the number one feedback I get from my readers is just, you know, you say what I'm thinking in a way that sounds practical. And
right.
I think that's what we do.
Yeah, you know, and it's helping to inform through opinion, right? It's like,
exactly.
I don't like this because, or this is stupid because, or these guys should be praised because, and let people decide whether they agree or not.
Right. I agree. I agree totally. And I think it's more interesting that way, because these days with the internet, you can get your quote information from anywhere. You know, you can pull facts and figures from anywhere. But
yeah.
I think what people are hungry for is analysis. And sometimes that analysis is biased. I'm okay with that, obviously. But I think as long as you understand that, you know, that's
right.
Fine.
As long as you go in admitting your bias and saying, this
exactly.
is my perspective, where I'm coming from, and this is what I'm fighting for.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
I think there's a more constructive conversations to be had when everyone can admit that that's what they're doing.
Right. Right. And that's the reason that nobody trusts the mainstream media, right, is that they've got their own perspective and they hide behind this thin veneer of impartiality, which everybody knows is BS.
Right. Right. And then lately, you know, then they ruin their reputations even more by literally falsifying stories and creating
totally.
Fake stories and running with fake narratives that are blatantly, you know, bald-faced, just lies to support their agenda or point of view. I hate to use the word agenda. It sounds conspiratorial, but their point of view, you know.
Well,
it
is a conspiracy.
I think that we can get bogged down in the semantics of it, but on a practical level, it is a real problem. And
yeah.
people are recognizing that. And not that the left-wing mainstream media doesn't have its fans. I mean, it's always going to have its diehard fans, but I think more and more people are coming to the opinion that a lot of what they're reading is opinion.
Right. Yeah, and they're seeking out their own sources and trying to validate the information that they're being fed by the big sources. So that's where we exist, is in that realm of either confirming or reframing or, you know, finding the real truth behind the headline.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you about a couple of your articles and your podcasts you've done recently. Specifically, a couple of episodes ago, I interviewed Rebecca Friedrichs of the Friedrichs versus CTA case that hit the Supreme
yeah.
Court. Rebecca's awesome, by the way. She's a force of nature. But we actually discussed your articles about the sex ed curriculum that you were objecting to. Talk a little bit about what you were looking at and kind of the results of your coverage of the school board meetings.
Well, I think a lot of people have heard by now that we're on the tail end, I would say, of a very contentious fight against a new sex ed curriculum that has come down across the board from in California. And it actually was ratified, approved into law in 2015. So it's been the law for 3 years. But as with a lot of stuff that happens in the public school system, it was just taking a while to matriculate through the system. Mm-hmm. And what's happened now is 3 years later, slowly school districts were coming to understand that they were going to be forced to be teaching this material. Now, it's not, if you and I are talking about sex ed, we think of like the birds and the bees, maybe some embarrassing conversations mm-hmm. about sex in the classroom. But this sex ed curriculum is actually an LGBT curriculum. So it's actually not even aimed at traditional heterosexual, you know, kids as well. It's almost exclusively an LGBT curriculum, and it includes lessons on all kinds of stuff that are so shocking I can't even say them on your podcast, you know.
Wow.
But they'll be in the classroom. There's materials headed to kindergarten right now on gender identity, transgenderism, and the worst part is it's not just for sex ed. It's actually a comprehensive program, which means it will be taught across all subjects. So your math word problems will include language about sexual identity and gender identity and transgender issues. In history class, you'll be talking about, quote, gay history. And in your social studies class, you'll be having conversations about social justice and things like that. So there is an option for parents to opt out of the sex ed part, but the rest of it they consider civil rights. You are not allowed to opt out of any civil rights conversations or materials in any classroom. So parents are just now starting to become aware that this is coming, that the school districts resisted for a while, and then the State Department of Education deliberately made the implementation and the legalization of it all pretty vague so that it was able to be hidden for a while. And now the ACLU is coming around and saying, oh, everyone's out of time. We're showing up at your school district meetings, and if you don't approve this curriculum and get started, you're going to start facing fines. So now parents are seeing it. And of course, now that parents know it exists, they hate it. Literally everybody hates it. Even most of the teachers hate it. The school districts hate it. There were no parents involved in the forming of this curriculum. It was largely formed by Planned Parenthood and the Human Rights Commission or campaign, which is an LGBT organization. There were no workshops on it. It wasn't tested. It wasn't brought up for any kind of vote as far as what parents can do want their kids talking about in school. So it's just kind of, we're being hit over the head with it now, and parents are waking up and they're getting scared. So we've organized a couple of protests up in Sacramento. We've protested in front of the State Board of Education right before they were taking their final votes to approve what's called the framework. It's fairly complicated, and they make it purposely so, but the framework is what the opposition will say is not a big deal. They'll say, look, we're not voting on curriculum. There's no new books being forced into your classroom. Then this is true. Although Planned Parenthood will provide you with free sex ed curriculum for your classroom if you want it. But there is approved curriculum, and teachers can use that curriculum as they choose for now. But what the framework does, it's like the bones of your house. It's like the wooden frame of your house. It sets up the structure of what is to come. So for right. the next 50 to 60 to 70 years until they vote on another framework, this will dictate how we work up lessons around sexual health and sexuality in our public schools.
And it sounds like what they're trying to do is it's not just a sex ed class, like you point out. It's making the sexual identity and the gender identity and all of that other stuff that some people may disagree with, they don't have a choice. It's going to insinuate itself into
yes.
every subject.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
This is like the most important thing they're teaching, not math and reading anymore.
Right, yeah, it is the most important important thing they're teaching. Absolutely. I'll tell you what some parents have come up against so far in their districts, and it varies district to district. I'm in a very conservative district. They have been actively resisting switching over to new curriculum for a while now. Of course, the ACLU has come. They show up at our meeting, at our school board meetings. They threaten people. I mean, it's been crazy. But my district has been resisting it. But other districts might have more liberal leadership. So I went to a school district meeting in Santa Ana, which is largely Hispanic population, largely immigrant population. Right. A lot of the people there are undocumented. I thought it was very interesting that they brought the police. I've never been to a school board meeting where there was a police presence, but there was a police presence at this one. And one of the parent representatives told me that the police were there to intimidate the undocumented parents from speaking.
Oh my goodness.
And then,
even though California is a sanctuary state and they're not allowed to arrest them.
Yes. California is a sanctuary state and Santa Ana is a sanctuary city. So
wow.
It's really,
so they know exactly what they're doing.
They know exactly what they're doing. And then a bunch of parents, mostly Hispanic, showed up to protest, and they showed up to give their little, you get 3 minutes at the meeting to talk about whatever you want. And a lot of parents still showed up. They weren't intimidated. I would say 70% of them needed interpreters. So that's the population that we're looking at. And right before the meeting started, the school board decided that they were going to cut public comments from 3 minutes to 1 minute. And they told
they can't
people,
do that.
Well, they did. They
wow.
did. They did. And they told people as the meeting started.
Wow, they can't do that.
They did it. And I'm sure Rebecca talked to you a bit about some of the intimidation tactics that have been used. And a lot of the things that are happening are illegal, which I think for us in the long run bodes well, because there will be a legal challenge down the road. And I think for us, some of that stuff bodes well. But they're doing what they can get away with.
Oh, yeah.
They can get away with a lot in the state because it's a one-party state. And the
yep.
government kind of rules everything.
Yeah,
so we're talking
we're
about lessons like,
go ahead.
Well, I have viewed some of the approved, like, curriculum that's recommended right now. It's not all printed up yet, but it's recommended, and you can get it from the state if you want it. I'm talking about lessons for kindergartens, about little boys who are princesses. And we're not even just talking about books about, you know, Johnny has two moms. We've moved way beyond now. Johnny is a girl. And I have viewed lessons for K through fifth grade on masturbation. I kid you not. I'm not
wow.
making it up. There are books that have graphic demonstrations of how to masturbate. The way they get this into the classroom is they classify it as abstinence education, because all sex all sexual health education has to include abstinence, and so they include masturbation and oral sex, yes, as abstinence. And so you get those
God.
Lessons in school. Yeah, there's lessons on anal fisting in some of the middle school texts.
Goodness gracious!
Again, under the guise of this is abstinence, and we don't want you having sex and spreading disease and risking pregnancy, so here are other options for you. I mean,
right.
I wish I was making it up. I'm not making it up.
I mean, that's still depravity. I mean, it's still licentiousness.
Yeah.
It's.
And I don't want my fifth grader's teacher having this discussion with her in a classroom with 30 other kids, while certainly not ever, but certainly while I'm not there.
I can't imagine most fifth grade teachers want to have that conversation
they don't.
Either.
They don't. And this is what this is. The other part of this story is that there are a lot of teachers who are also feeling very uncomfortable about this. This is not what they signed on to do. They're not supportive of it. They don't want, they recognize that this is far too sexualized for the children that they're dealing with. But they feel that they're, you know, I mean, it's the law. It's the law. And the ACLU is showing up at all our meetings and saying, if you don't do this, you'll be fined.
Wow. Okay, so we're bumping up the clock here. So I want to leave you. I want to set you up with two final questions here. One is, give me your thumbnail sketch of the state of social media right now, and the other is, with the Democratic field in 2020 for the presidential race, are they guaranteeing a Trump victory?
Okay, boy, the state of social media, it's like a dumpster fire, isn't it? I would say dumpster fire is, it's so interesting. I was watching some Joe Rogan on YouTube the other day, and he had Jack from Twitter on,
yep.
a couple of Twitter representatives, and they had a really productive conversation about the state of the platform and conservatives getting banned. Of course, Jack, you know, claimed that that doesn't happen, that there's no bias. And but I think social media is, I don't know, I get the feeling that it's, the rage is sort of coming to a head, because and it might be a year or two before that head really, you know, gets swollen and red, but that is ready to like pop like a pimple. But I think it's starting to happen, because you're seeing so many other people being the victims of social media abuse. So it's not just conservatives. When it was just conservatives, that was fine. But now everyone's getting caught up in the ridiculousness and the hysterical nature of social media, how it amplifies hysterical voices. And of course, reasonable people aren't shouting on Twitter or Facebook, and so it seems like those people aren't out there. But I feel like it's coming to a head. You're starting to see people from the left even saying, whoa, 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 hang on, this is getting out of control.
Well, don't you think it also gins up so much outrage that it spills over into real life? I mean, there's so many examples of people being harassed in real life because of some Twitter spat they got into.
Yeah, I think, well, that's interesting, and I think that's a part of it, but I don't know. I would say that the worst part of social media is that it gives, it paints such a black and white picture and erases all the nuances and erases the middle, that it gives people who want a sense of purpose, a justification for being as hateful as they probably are already really are. And that's why you'll see, you know, grown men walking up to teenagers in a restaurant and throwing drinks in their faces and pulling off their red MAGA caps.
Right.
And feeling totally justified in that, even though that's absolutely utterly assault. Like, in polite society, we do not do that to strangers. And, but that barrier has been erased for some people, but I still don't think those people make up the majority of society. I just think we have our phones out more to catch those things. But I do think that it's coming to a place where people are starting to reconsider their reliance on social media outside of what they do for work.
Because it's such a powerful tool. I mean, that's how you and I met so many people, right? Is through Twitter. You have access to people you'd never dream of having access to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's been so many good things about it, and I hate to always be on Jack's case, because, and same with Zuckerberg, I mean, they built these platforms that have done really amazing things. And excuse me, I'm okay to concede some measure of privacy to that, because I'm making a trade-off. I'm willingly engaging in this relationship. So that being said, I think Trump came along and burned so many people, you know, so many people, the mainstream media kicked in and social media kicked in, and everyone told the left that it was a lock for Hillary and there was no way she could win. And so it just built up this great expectation, and Trump was that pin that burst the balloon, and people couldn't believe it. I really feel that this is really a fault of the media more than social media. They built this up so much that then people were outraged. They felt like something dirty had to have happened for this to happen. And then that set off the rage we see on social media. But there's good parts to it, of course. And I don't want to get rid of social media. I think it works best. I'm sure you agree with me, when it's just a free platform where people are free to express their ideas, good and bad.
Freedom of expression. That's what it's all about. And then if there's a criminal line crossed, let the justice system deal with it. Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So this is a good point to kind of pivot and say, okay, what does the 2020 field look like? I mean, because you've got the resistors going so far to the left, and they're competing with each other to get further and further to the left. My feeling on this is that Trump is probably going to win the popular vote now because they're all crazy.
Yeah, I do. I think I was, you know, we recorded Smarker Podcast yesterday and we were just having the same conversation. And I said, you know, one of the things, I hate to say it, but I'm a reasonable person. Like, I definitely believe we need a right and we need the left. We need the left, people, because if the country can't just be all conservative, then we'll just pull too far in that direction. There's got to be a balance in the force, right?
Yeah.
But I just wish there was, you know, fewer people of that ideology. But there's a part of me that really hoped that they had learned their lesson after in you know, the weeks following the election. Once people calmed down, there were a bunch of liberal commentators that came out and said, hey, you know what? We missed it. We missed something here. We missed the story that, you know, half of this country feels ignored, that, you know, half of this country feels left out of the conversation, and they're reacting, and we need to go and talk to those people and learn what they want and how they think. And that lasted like a week. And then, and then we just went back to hashtag resist. And the crazier people get, I think the more it drives reasonable people to the center. And that's all they need to do, is be moving in that direction. They do not need to be right wing to vote for Trump. We saw in 2016, hundreds of thousands of people cross the aisle to vote for Trump. Obama voters, entire counties of people, of Obama voters, switching for Trump. So we know that he doesn't even have to move that needle that much to get those people. And the left seem to be driving those people to the center just because they can't be that crazy all the time. Most people in America are just regular people. I think, look, Dave Rubin is a great example of it. You know, I think he's a high profile example, but I think he represents that hundreds of thousands of Americans who are just like, you know what? I am liberal. I am progressive. But, you know, I don't think that we should be, you know, letting men compete in women's sports. And I don't think that, you know, we should be teaching kids how to masturbate in kindergarten. And I don't, you know, and I don't think you're hateful just because you want to eat a chicken sandwich at Chick-fil-A.
Right.
You know?
Good old hate chicken.
Right. I don't believe your whole life should be destroyed over that. So I think there's a whole lot of people out there who are feeling that way. Honestly, Jeff, we both know we lived through 2016. I mean, anything can happen, right?
Right.
It just looks like they want Trump to win, to be honest.
It really does. I mean, it's almost deliberate, right?
Yeah, it's so crazy. Like, I just think, like, I don't know who Alyssa Milano thinks she's influencing right. or, like, who is she persuading? And I think that's what the Democrat field needs. I'll actually be at the California Democrat Convention at the end of the month, covering it for Red State and Town Hall Media. And all of the candidates will be there. Yeah, it's going to be a real freak show. So I'm actually really looking forward to it. But what's interesting to me is to see all of these people who have presidential aspirations and saw with their own eyes how divisive the Obama administration was, and how it drove people to want to vote for Trump, to burn it all down.
Well, and it spawned the Tea Party movement and all of these conservatives that never knew they were conservatives, like me. And we got involved in politics, and now we're a permanent fixture in politics. So thank you very much.
Yeah, they hate that. And I think it's still happening.
Yeah,
I think it's
absolutely.
Still happening. They're still driving people to that side. And so here are all these candidates, and they want to be the next president to unite people, and yet they're talking about people on the right, people who hold right of center ideological views, as if they are the second coming of Hitler. And it's just, it's not helpful, and it is a joke. We joke about it a lot, but at the same time, on a serious note, these are your fellow Americans you're talking about. These
right.
are human beings. They're actual people. And when you win the presidency, if you win the presidency, you'll need to be their president too. So yeah. It seems to me they're just, it's the same playbook. It's like Obama came and he changed the game, right? Republicans could not catch up with Obama. He flipped that script and we never caught up. But then Trump came in and did the same thing. And now it's the Democrats who are scrambling. And I don't even think they're in the right playbook.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And there's, what is it, 23 now presidential candidates on the left? And
23.
Each of them is more obscure than the last. Like, you know, Kirsten Gillibrand and Pete Buttigieg. And who are these people?
yesterday it was, Bullock from Montana. See, I don't
even
know
the governor of Montana. There's a sizable minority of America that doesn't even know that Montana's a state.
Right, it's so true. I watched. he had a 4-minute campaign launch video. I watched the whole thing because I wanted to write it up for Red State. I watched the whole thing, and then as I was writing up for Red State, I immediately forgot his name. the three legs of his platform and his slogan. I forgot everything. He was just completely forgettable. So I don't know.
Well, speaking of which, did you see Jay Inslee's video riding his little scooter?
No.
Oh, my God. It's a Michael Dukakis moment. It's fantastic.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. Well, Beto was getting his hair cut today. Remember him?
Yeah. Oh, that's right. He's still
running. He was the guy, and then Buttigieg got in, and then he's like basically he's gay, so he's like the better Beto.
Right. No, he doesn't have any intersectionality to lean on. So he's not gay, he's not brown, he's not a woman, he's not transgender. So
they tried to make that Hispanic thing happen for a hot second.
Right.
But I think if you're and him and Buttigieg kind of have that same vibe. So if you got to pick between the two of them. For instance, Buttigieg was just in L.A., a big fundraiser held by Gwyneth Paltrow and a couple of other celebrities for him.
Oh, boy.
I mean, just months ago, Gwyneth was stumping for Beto O'Rourke. So that was a huge loss, and you saw him just, quote, relaunch his campaign.
He had to reboot the campaign. I was actually surprised. I thought Beto was going to do better because he got all this national street cred for taking on Ted Cruz, and he raised $70 million for his Senate race. I thought that positioned him pretty well, but I think when there's no there, he's not in position to do anything.
I think his people thought that too, and they talked him into running for president. But the fact was that it was the Trump phenomenon in a lot of ways. People were voting against, a lot of people who voted for Trump were actually voting against Hillary. I think this time people will vote for Trump, but
yeah,
a lot of people were voting against Hillary. And in the Cruz and Beto race, a lot of people were voting against Ted Cruz, and that's why they were sending him all the money.
Right.
Cruz was considered a Trump sympathizer, and so Beto just was the hot ticket of the day. But I mean,
and most of his money came from out of state.
Almost all of it did. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he really outlived his usefulness, and then he just wasn't charismatic enough to carry that over into a national campaign. And you know, you see Buttigieg kind of sprinting in front of him in the likability category, and then he's got that great identifier, gay. So, you know, that's too attractive for Democrats to leave on the table.
Well, yeah, it's all about how many boxes you can check.
Right. And I think that's another problem, and I think it's a silly endeavor because at the end of the day, we're just going to choose between two white guys.
Right, it's going to be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump.
It's going to be Joe Biden and like Kamala, or he was mentioning Stacey Abrams. I think she's crazy.
Oh, she's nuts.
Yeah, I don't mean that in like we disagree on a lot of stuff. I actually think she's like mentally ill, and I mean that in the kindest way possible. I actually think she's mentally ill, so I don't think that once you start vetting her, she's going to make it through that process.
Right, and that's
I saw Kamala talking about Biden today.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah. No, they've been playing footsie for a while here. I wonder what else Kamala Harris is doing to secure the VP slot, if you know what I mean.
No. Oh, well, she's so interesting because everybody hates her. I don't even know where she's getting her support. Like, even here, California is her home state, and most people, most liberal people in California don't like her.
Right. Well, she's not a likable person. She's like
Hillary. Yeah, she's not. She really isn't. So I just, it's interesting that she's running and still so high profile, but I think that's a media construct, and I don't think it translates to the voters. A lot of Obama voters don't like her because she had butted heads with Michelle, and there was rumors. A lot of black people think that Kamala and Barack, Kamala was like trying to have an affair with Barack.
Well, so, I mean, it's not like that's not part of her history.
Okay, you know, and these are not just salacious statements. I mean, these are pretty well-known things, and around California politics, it's pretty well-known. I mean, it's not a secret. So I don't think she has the popularity to pull it out. I know Cory Booker was, I think he's just running for a job at this point.
Well, yeah, and that's what all these guys are doing, right? I mean, there's 23 of them, and like I said before, they're each is more obscure than the last. They're just trying to grab the spotlight. They're going for the book deal afterwards, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Biden's what running like, what, 20 points ahead?
Well, and, of course, because he's got name ID. He's been around forever.
Right. I just, who knows? It's a long road to 2020. Anything can happen. I think Trump has not been able to finish what he started, but he's done a great job of really keeping some of his promises. And I think that's going to be attractive to a lot of people. And I think in big states like California or along the West Coast, we're starting to see the real life consequences of sanctuary cities, an unprotected border. We have a homeless issue that's out of control here, which is related to the drug issue and related to the illegal immigrant issue. People are coming face to face with these realities and they don't like it.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they're really convinced that the Democrats have the answer to it. So they might not be voting Republican, but I think there's going to be a lot of people who are voting for Trump this time around.
Yeah, you know, I think there's certainly going to be the Republican Party is really still doing a bad job of reaching out to these people that want to walk away from the Democrats. But there's no doubt about the fact, you know, I'm up here in Oregon, you're in California, all three of the West Coast states have been dominated by Democrats for so long, and things are awful. And I think that people are starting to wake up to that. So there's going to be a huge undervote for the Democrats if the Republicans position themselves to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I wish that Trump would come campaign here. I do.
Yeah.
I really think there are some votes to be called. I don't know. I don't want to be so bold as to say a state like California is going to flip, but it could strike, you know, it could put some fear in the hearts of some Democrats if Trump were able to peel off some of the popular vote here in California.
Yeah.
And I believe it's ripe for him, especially with this sex ed thing here in California. It's really disturbing a lot of people, and even a lot of the immigrants in our communities don't want to see any more illegal immigrants coming over the border.
No, that's right.
Just today, we've been dealing with homeless people, like murders committed by homeless people. We have such a huge problem in Southern California. I mean, just yesterday, a woman was beaten with an electric scooter, beaten to death by a homeless person.
Holy cow.
A homeless person.
Yeah, somebody in Southeast Portland was attacked by a hatchet by a meth addict just the other day. So,
yeah,
I mean, it's all over the place.
It's all over the place, and it's in liberal places. And I wish Trump would come here and make an effort. I wish the Republicans would put more of an effort into California and in the West Coast. I do think there are some advantages to be gained.
Yeah, you know, there are two advantages. One is up here in Oregon, you know, California is an enormous, immense state, but Oregon's pretty small electorally. We only have about 4.2 million people. So if we got an injection of $5 to $10 million, we could have a huge impact on turning this state around. You know, it wouldn't take very much at all from a relative standpoint. But the other thing is, if you consider all of the states that are considering the National Popular Vote Compact, it would be absolutely delicious to make all those states give all their electoral votes to Trump if he won the popular vote.
I'm really keeping my fingers crossed for that. I didn't even realize that that was a legal thing that you could do. And I'm still not sure that it is, but we'll see if it gets challenged before 2020. But yeah, I mean, there's a good chance that that would happen. And keep in mind, Hillary didn't win that popular vote by that much.
No,
Not.
it was a couple of percentage points. It was within the margin of error. So
Well, we're in the
now, of
margin of
course,
error, and
yeah.
there were plenty of shenanigans at play in certain places, like here in California, here in
Oh,
Orange
yeah.
County. And so, yeah, it's not hard to conceive that Trump could win the popular vote.
Right. Now, on the flip side, of course, it wasn't a historical electoral college vote by any stretch. He only won it by, I think, a total of 87,000 votes in three states. And, he only
Yeah.
won, what, 304, 305 electoral votes. So it was a squeaker and it was a surprise to everybody. But, I think, the landscape that we have now has demonstrated to normal people how crazy the fringe of the Democrat Party has become, and the fringe is starting to become mainstream. So it's going to push people away from the Democrats for sure.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, you're looking at the new wing of the Democrat Party, which is AOC and Ilhan Omar. I mean, even Nancy Pelosi can't seem to handle them, which I'm so shocked by, but I guess she's getting older. She's to rule with an iron fist. I don't know what's
She
going
has
on.
to.
But yeah, you're seeing those people, and I think there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with that measure of just blatant, Marxism, blatant racism, blatant anti-Semitism. I don't care what anyone tells you. I think there are a lot of people who are uncomfortable with the fact that Ilhan Omar seems to have ties to culturally speaking, to Islamist views and ideology. And I don't think a lot of Americans are comfortable with that, whether or not they're on the left or the right.
Yeah, I think AOC is just kind of a clown show. I think she's just, comic relief. She doesn't scare me nearly as much as Ilhan Omar. The fact that a woman like that, with those ties, with those extremist views and those,
Yeah.
ties to terrorism, got elected in America really frightens. I mean, it's less than 20 years since 9/11.
Yeah. Yeah, well, right. Well, we could talk about how all that happened and yeah. But yeah, she's from, and she's safe. I mean, she's from a district that she's going to die before she gets booted
Yeah, she
out.
checks some boxes.
Yeah, she checks the box. I mean, she's from an immigrant community, and that's part of the problem. I'm using air
I
quotes.
mean, yeah, the fact that we created this entire voting block out of whole cloth in her area, and that's what got her elected.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, there are some disturbing things going on in those communities, things we only think of as happening in the suburbs of Paris or London. But those
Or
that stuff
Detroit.
is here on our shores, and she's a perfect example of it. Anyways, it's going to be an interesting, 18 months or so, seeing how this shapes up. That is for sure. But my money's on Trump right now.
Yeah, I'd say so. The only thing that would stop it, I think, at this point is a recession, which is always around the corner.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, we'll see. All
Yeah.
right. Well, Kara, thanks so much for joining me. I want to thank you once again for interviewing me on your podcast a couple of months ago about my book, and I appreciate everything you do, and I always appreciate our friendship. It's been a crazy ride over the last 8 or 10 years, and so thanks again for giving me your analysis of all of the interesting things going on.
Well, it's been my pleasure, Jeff. And again, congratulations on your book. And I wish you all the best success moving forward.
Thank you. Thank you. Real quick, let's tell everybody where they can find you on social media, the blog, the podcast, all that stuff. Pimp it out.
You can follow me on Twitter at RealKiraDavis. You can follow me on Facebook. My public Facebook page is Kira Ein Davis. That actually is my real name.
I didn't know
And
that.
yes, my mom was a big Ayn, well, I say Ayn. We say Ayn. My mom was a big Ayn Rand fan. Of course, she was a hippie, a liberal hippie, but back then, Ayn Rand was counterculture.
That's funny.
So yeah, Kira is a character from one of her books, and then she named my middle name. And she's still a huge liberal hippie, but that is my name. And let's see, you can follow the Smart Girl Politics podcast, of course. That's me and April D. Gregory. We podcast every week. Ricochet is our home. You can look for us over at ricochet.com or find us on iTunes and subscribe. You can get all of our lovely commentary over there. And then, of course, head over to Red State, where I am the editor at large. You can see all of my op-ed pieces over there. And sometimes you can see me slumming it over at Fox News. As a matter of fact, they'll be on, I'm not sure when this podcast is coming out, but on the 19th, I will be on The Next Revolution with Steve Hilton on Fox News. So you can see me there.
Very cool. Right on. Yeah, I actually follow your Smart Girl Politics on Google Podcasts, so it's available on several different platforms.
Yes, it is. Great. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Thanks a lot, Kira Davis.
If you like this podcast, the best way you can support it is by leaving a rating and subscribing. And don't forget to buy my book, Behind the Curtain, Inside the Network of Progressive Billionaires and Their Campaign to Undermine Democracy. Now it's on to the Pacific Northwest story of the week with John Lee from Southwest Washington.
Welcome into the local segment of the Behind the Curtain podcast with Jeff Reynolds. My guest today is a former state legislative candidate in the state of Washington, lives in Camas. He's an activist and an observer and concerned citizen regarding all things transportation in Oregon and Washington, mostly Washington, but the Columbia River Crossing obviously plays a big part in that. So I want to welcome in John Lee.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having me. It's great to have the opportunity to talk shared concerns about transportation.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much insanity going on right now. You look at between Oregon and Washington, I'm not sure who's worse.
Well, and they kind of mirror each other. They look to each other for ideas. Basically, you know, sadly, for the average citizen just wants to get to and from work, to and from the grocery store, to their kids' schools, to the kids' soccer game, whatever, in an efficient manner. And the mindset, especially in Portland, is, as we call it, the war on cars, but that's mirrored in Seattle. And they therefore, to the casual observer and even the not-so-casual observer, refuse to spend transportation money actually expanding roads and bridges that would make transportation faster and more efficient.
Yeah, and I actually wrote, I actually ran for Metro in 2010, and that was my argument about the Columbia River Crossing at the time. I was the only one, I was the only candidate that was saying, hey, we ought to make that bridge as wide as possible to make people idle and traffic less. If you're really concerned about global warming and carbon emissions, you want to make transportation efficient. You don't want to make it inefficient. You want to have that thing as wide as possible and get people over the bridge as quickly as you can.
Yeah, absolutely. And as was demonstrated in the later part of that battle, the morning southbound commute with what they proposed was only going to provide a 1 minute improvement in the morning commute time. You know, nobody in their right mind would spend $1 billion for a 1 minute improvement, let alone $3.5 billion and only net a 1 minute improvement. It was crazy.
Right, right. Meanwhile, I think it was another Clark County commissioner came up with the idea a couple of years ago to do a bridge between, I believe it was 164th in Vancouver and 181st here in Gresham, that would have cost less than $1 billion and would have offloaded a significant amount of traffic. And we wouldn't have had to worry about federal funds.
Yeah. You know, that was County Commissioner David Medore, and it was an East County bridge proposal from Figg Engineering. Figg's built bridges all over the world. They're known, generally respected. But his specific proposal, they offered a fixed price, guaranteed, no government cost overruns or whatever. $840 million to build a bridge that connected from 192nd Avenue on the Vancouver side, and they looked, and the intention was to connect it with 181st in Portland, but there's a little marina, and there's some housing and some infrastructure there at 181st on the Portland side. So they looked and said, you know what, if we move it a little further west to around 168th or whatnot, we would impact a lot fewer homes and businesses, and therefore you get a lot better buy-in. But bottom line, it was $840 million fixed price guarantee, and you've got a brand new bridge across the Columbia River. They later came back as information and said, listen, if you want to build a bridge further east, i.e. connecting Camas to Troutdale, and by the way, the mayors of Troutdale, Fairview, and Wood Village went on record submitting a letter to the Clark County Council saying, we want a bridge connecting I-84 with our neighborhoods, with our cities, at around exit 17 off Interstate 84.
Yep.
And so, bottom line, Fig Engineering said, Columbia River's narrower there. You don't have to build to the height that you do at 192nd, and therefore they said they could do it for $800 million. Now, that's an incredible bargain compared to a $3.5 billion CRC.
Well, right, and the Columbia River Crossing didn't even expand the number of travel lanes. It just expanded exits and entrances. But the real intention, as we all know, was to shove light rail down Clark County's throat.
Absolutely right. And that was properly stated by an Oregon Supreme Court justice who labeled the project a light rail project in search of a bridge. And, you know, sadly, we are faced with that exact same situation today. Both Oregon Governor Kate Brown and Washington Governor Jay Inslee have said in the current round of discussions over replacing the interstate bridge, hey, any replacement bridge must have light rail. And therefore, guess what? We're back to a light rail project in search of a new bridge.
Right. And we will probably not have any expansion of travel lanes, as we discussed earlier. The CRC died, when was it, 2015 or whatever it was? And it died because of that, but it's being revived basically as the same project as it was before.
Yeah, they won't admit that it's the same project, but it essentially is.
Yeah.
Portland Metro has three different projects in their 20-year plan, but the total of those three projects is $4.1 billion, and it, in essence, is extending light rail into Clark County and doing the three different pieces of infrastructure, one replacing the interstate bridge, number two, building a separate bridge from Delta Park on to Hayden Island, and then third, doing the light rail extension into Clark County, and total price tag $4.1 billion.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, and therefore, you know, they don't hide it. It's not talked about. It's not covered in the press, but it's in their 20-year plan. Clark County, our Regional Transportation Council, not as graphic, but they have $3.3 billion in their 20-year plan just for an indescribed bridge across the river.
Right.
And, you know, the only way you get to that kind of a price tag is to include light rail on it.
Yeah, and they're hoping to get some of that federal money back, which is really what they're going for, is the federal funds that come back for alternate transportation plans. The whole thing is insane because they are, as we talked about offline, they're actually waging war on the internal combustion engine. They are trying to force people to stop driving their cars and to buy into mass transit and alternate forms of transit. But the way light rail works, it can't possibly serve all of the needs of all of the citizens of our metro region.
No, it can't. And the honest analysis of TriMet's light rail with the MAX line is that the number of people riding it has declined, I believe, since 2011. It's been an annual decline. in light rail ridership, and that is in spite of them adding new lines. You know, so, every new line should attract new customers, but it doesn't.
Right, but that's their argument about freeways, right? Is that if you build more freeways, it'll attract more drivers. But if you build more light rail, it doesn't attract more riders. So none of the stuff they're saying actually makes any what the kids are calling sense these days.
Yeah. You know, and there's an interesting dialogue that needs to happen. The quote-unquote induced demand, which the opponents of building more roads, bridges, freeway lanes say, oh, you're just going to induce new demand. And it's a catchy slogan. But the reality is, for those of us that have been here in the Portland metro area for any length of time, the last new bit of new freeway, highway, express lanes to get around was the I-205 corridor that opened in December of 1982.
Right.
So you're looking at 40 years of no significant additions to road capacity, freeway capacity for people to get around. Yet in that same 40-year time frame, populations doubled.
That at least.
The number of cars has doubled. And of course, you end up with the nation's 10th worst traffic congestion when your population doubles and you add no new net capacity in terms of roads, freeways, bridges, highways.
Yeah, demand is growing despite their insistence on not expanding capacity.
Yeah, and so you nailed it. Demand is growing, and therefore, where are all those cars going? Because they're here, they're living here, they're trying to get. Well, obviously, first and foremost, they're making our roads and freeways infinitely more congested so that Portland has the 10th worst traffic congestion in the nation, number one. But number two, because the freeways and highways are so congested, they're dumping onto the side roads. You know, I use Sandy Boulevard all the time as an alternative to an over-congested Interstate 84.
Sure.
You know, people will use, you know, 82nd Avenue and 122nd Avenue as alternatives to I-205 for going north-south. You know, all over the region, people are going into the side roads.
And what they're doing is they're actually putting the Portland surface streets on a road diet, which is the exact opposite of what they should be doing. They've already changed Foster Boulevard to one lane each direction instead of what it used to be two. And they're trying to do the same thing for, I think it's Powell, and then also 102nd Avenue. Have you heard about the 102nd Avenue plan?
Not specifically that. I'm aware of the Powell Boulevard one. They're also, they've done some on Interstate Avenue and Vancouver Avenue. Yeah, they're making that argument to reduce it either for buses or bicyclists or both, and therefore the road diet is extremely real.
Yeah, absolutely. So this 102nd plan that they have, 102nd is a major alternative to I-205 when it gets congested at rush hour. So that gets backed up now when it's two lanes in each direction. When they cut it down to one lane each direction, you're going to be backed up all the way to Southeast Portland.
Yeah. And, you know, the other part of this whole aspect, the reality is the citizens hate it. And everybody's got cell phones with Waze or some other, you know, application that tells them the faster, better way to get around. And so what's happening anywhere you go in the Portland metro area, you know, Waze or the various apps are say, hey, get off here, go here. Oh, there's now too much traffic on 102nd. So then Waze will take them, you know, a couple roads to the south, hey, or the east or the west. Hey, drive 92nd. Oh, drive on this. And they're zipping through the neighborhoods. And understandably, the people in the neighborhoods are outraged, so they're demanding the city put speed bumps or roundabouts that slow traffic down going through the neighborhoods. Well, if they just built enough roads on the major arteries, those cars wouldn't be zipping through the neighborhoods.
Right, but we also heard back in the day when Sam Adams was mayor, he didn't want to encourage quote-unquote car abuse with this CRC. That's why he didn't want to expand lanes.
Yep. The other aspect of this, there's currently a great debate over what ODOT is going to do or not going to do at the Rose Quarter. And at the end of the day, we started talking about expanding or not expanding lanes over the Interstate 5 bridge coming into Portland. But again, the Rose Quarter chokes the pipe, if you will, down to just two lanes in each direction.
Yep.
And you need more lanes than you have at the Interstate bridge at the Rose Quarter, because you've got everybody getting on Hayden Island, Delta Park, Rosa Parks Way, Swan Island exit, all of that are getting onto the freeway heading south. And so you need a bigger pipe, if you will, a wider freeway there at the Rose Quarter. And the auxiliary lane that they are going to add will help a little bit, but it doesn't even come close. And therefore, you're still going to have huge traffic congestion at the Rose Quarter.
Right, but their argument against this is this typical social justice warrior argument that, well, adding freeway capacity is privilege and it doesn't help poor people. It's absurd. It has nothing to do with reality.
Yeah, exactly right. And, first and foremost, generally speaking, it's current car drivers, truck drivers, that are paying for what ODOT's going to do. Their gas taxes, their car and vehicle registration fees that are putting up the money. And therefore, it ought to be that money used to add lanes. Certainly, most importantly, it's the poor person that needs to get to work in an efficient way. And painting with a broad brush, it's the poor single mom that needs to drop the kids off at school and then get to work in as fast a way possible, and then get off work and get back to school or the daycare center to pick up the kids after she gets off work. She's going to be the one who cannot afford the tolls that ODOT wants to impose on I-5. She's the one impacted. The social justice warriors ought to be outraged by the ODOT proposal, which in reality is the legislature's proposal, to toll all of I-5 and I-205. That's going to be unbelievably harmful to those poor people, and therefore the social justice warriors ought to be all over this saying, no, this is an outrage. This harms the poorest among us the most.
Yeah, but I've seen the polling numbers. We don't need the social justice warriors on this one. It's an issue that 70 to 75% of Portlanders agree on, that we should not be doing tolling. It's only going to hurt single family budgets and make people angrier and make commuting more inconvenient and more expensive. And it's not necessary. We already have these gas taxes that are supposed to be dedicated to road projects, and they're not. They're going into light rail and mass transit and alternate forms of transit and other things that aren't even related to transit, like bike lanes and stuff like that. So it's what they're doing is exactly the opposite of finding a solution.
Yeah, exactly right. And you appropriately mentioned recent tolls. The Oregon Transportation Commission released a poll, or the results of a poll, in April of this year. Only 3% of the respondents said favorably they wanted to add a toll on the interstates to from Washington.
Wow.
Only 6% of the people said they wanted ODOT to encourage carpooling or changing travel times.
Wow.
Only 11% said add multimodal options, which means mass transit. 14% said they want ODOT to expand and improve arterial roads.
Hmm.
The major non-highway thoroughfares,
right.
And overwhelmingly 51% said they wanted ODOT and the OTC to expand and improve interstates, major highways, and interstate bridges. You know, so you're exactly right. Overwhelmingly, the people in Oregon want roads, bridges, arterial lanes improved with their transportation dollars.
Yeah, you know, and there was an article, I think last week or the week before in the Portland Tribune, I think it was Jessica Vega Peterson, who was at a town hall and said that, well, it's up to us to convince the voters that our ideas are better than theirs. So they don't even care about the polling numbers.
Yeah, you're right. They're trying to fight and ignore that reality. A second poll, and I got from a Portland Tribune study, was released in January of this year, and it was a Metro poll. And it showed that 31% of the people favored widening roads and highways, as opposed to only 13% chose faster bus and improving MAX service. So that was 2.5 times more people chose widening roads and highways rather than improving mass transit.
So I want to pivot a little bit here and talk about revenues and how they're being used and all that stuff. I wanted to make sure that because you brought this issue up, and the reason I actually wanted you on the podcast today is apparently Jay Inslee is talking about bonding future toll revenues that haven't even been approved yet, which is something I actually wrote about for PJ Media a couple of weeks ago, that the Connecticut governor is trying to do in that state as well. How insane is that idea?
Insane's an appropriate word, my friend. And sadly, this has already been passed by the Washington State Legislature.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yep. And they introduced a whole lot of tax bills that were title only. And in the rough week, the final week of the legislative session, at 10 o'clock at night or 1 in the morning, they then revealed the text of the bills and, you know, no public scrutiny on it, but it ultimately passed. And what the legislature authorized was Washington State DOT, WSDOT, could go out and borrow $1.5 billion. And what they do is they go to Wall Street and they say, we want to bond this future stream of revenue. We want to borrow $1.5 billion. And so what happens is Wall Street will go out, they'll look at, all right, how many cars do you expect? What are the tolls going to be? Blah, 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 blah. And they'll come back and they'll say, okay, we will loan you $1.5 billion, and you're going to have to pay it back 20 to 30 year time frame. We don't know the specifics. But number one, Wall Street is going to scrape off, rough wag, between $150 and $200 million of what you're borrowing.
Right.
So WSDOT will only get $1.3 billion to go buy roads, bridges, highways, whatever. They're never given the full $1.5 billion. Then, when you look at how long it's going to take and the source of revenues to pay it back, I did a back-of-the-napkin calculation figuring the total cost of paying this back was going to be close to $4.5 billion that drivers were going to have to pay over a 30-year period due to the cost of bonding the tolls.
Wow.
Yeah, and a further part of the insanity, and that's a 30-year loan. So, in essence, that makes the tolls permanent because, oh, we have to pay off this loan for 30 years. 30 years from now, nobody's going to remember what the original food fight was about.
Right, of course.
They're better and worse going to get used to it, number one. Number two, there's a perverse incentive for the DOT to keep roads congested and to jack up toll rates, because if they ever come back and fix traffic congestion by adding more lanes or building alternative bypass highways and stuff, then people are going to use the free roads instead of the tolled roads. Toll revenues drop, and then WashDOT won't have the money to pay off the loan.
Yep.
So now their incentive is to keep roads congested so that people pay the money for the 30 years.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny when you talk about these bonding issues, and you know, we just passed a big $658 billion or $1 million affordable housing bond in Metro here, and it makes me think back to when I ran for Metro in 2010, and I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but back then, the budget still included paying off the bond for building the convention center in 1992. So
yep.
it's amazing. You know, it's absolutely kicking the can down the road and drowning us in debt.
Yeah, it's living off the taxpayer's credit card. We're going to make promises today, and you're going to pay for the next 20 or 30 years.
Yeah, it's absolutely mortgaging our future.
Yep. So one additional aspect of this whole concept of bonding tolls, tolling is unbelievably inefficient as a means of raising money to buy transportation projects. Generally speaking, they fund transportation projects, road and bridges, via the gas tax. And the gas tax has just under a 1% cost of collection.
Okay.
So overly simplistic, you raise gas taxes and you're going to raise $100 million a year, the state's going to be able to keep $99 million of it to go buy roads, bridges, repair things, do new things, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Only $1 million goes to the cost of collection. So now let's look at tolling. Painting with a very broad brush, nationally, you're looking at a third of the cost of tolling revenue goes to the cost of collection.
Because you got to build the toll booths, you have to staff them and all that.
Yeah, you maintain them. The cost of collection is very, very significant.
Yeah.
Well, last year in 2018, on I-405 in the Seattle area, the total cost of collection was 43% of the toll collection. Now, that's the definition of insanity.
Right.
Now,
and then you're going to borrow against future revenues that aren't guaranteed anyway.
Yeah. And so in our example, you want to pick the pockets of the citizens for $100 million a year. If you pick the pockets and pay it off via the gas tax, the Department of Transportation ends up with $99 million a year to pay back borrowed money, to fix and improve roads, bridges, whatever.
Yeah.
If your payback, if you're raising $100 million, using tolls, the DOT only gets to keep $57 million instead of $99
million. Right.
That's the insanity of this. Then when you go to bond, you borrow money. Very rough wag. If in the $100 million scenario, if you paid a 4% interest rate, the $99 million gas tax revenue, it would take 18 years to pay off the $1.5 billion. But if you borrow it and you're going to pay it back via tolls, where you only get to keep $57 million, it's going to take you over 50 years to pay back that same $1.5 billion in borrowed money.
And that bond money that you raise is really just going to maintenance for 1 year's worth of work.
Well, yeah, I mean, the 43% maintains the tolling system and the toll lanes and pays the outside firm, private firms, that collect the tolls on behalf of the government and all of that.
Right.
The remaining 57%, it could go to maintain, but in this case, you borrow money. The outside firms are not going to let you claim the full 57%. They know tolling revenue is very sketchy, very risky, so they might only loan you, 40 or 45%. Of that, because they know if the economy tanks, tolling revenue goes down. You know, I mean, there's a whole host of very risky things tied to tolling revenue, and therefore Wall Street, the outsiders, don't like the concept of bonding toll revenue. And if they do, you're going to pay a price for it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so we've detailed how insane the approach is in the Pacific Northwest to transportation issues, both in Oregon and Washington. Real quick, let's wrap it up with some solutions. What would you like to see Washington DOT and Oregon DOT do with the money, and how would you like to see them make transportation more efficient in the region?
Well, different aspects. Great question. First and foremost, they need to take the money they're already getting and use it to add roads, bridges, fix the transportation infrastructure. You know, last fall, PEMCO did a survey. 95% of the people want to use their cars. If you acknowledge that reality, you're going to use the money we already raise instead of funding light rail. Instead of funding expanded mass transit systems, you're going to pour it into roads, bridges, and vehicle infrastructure. And that's the number one thing. Number two, given the reality that they've borrowed a bunch of money already against gas taxes and stuff, if they're going to go forward, my suggestion is you raise the gas tax and then you pay as you go. Don't pay interest on the borrowed money by bonding. Pay as you go. And if you raise gas taxes and it raises an additional $50 million a year, then you prioritize and use that $50 million where it's needed most to reduce the traffic congestion. Clearly, we could spend forever. Just in the Portland metro area, you need a West Side bypass.
Absolutely.
You know, Representative Rich Vile hit a home run, courageously proposing a West Side bypass in the 2017 legislative session. It didn't get anywhere, but it's still totally needed. Believe it or not, the original plan in the 1970s, when they designed and built I-205, that was only half the plan. The other half of the plan was to build a West Side bypass.
Yep.
And politicians refused to spend the money then to build the West Side Bypass. That would have been so cheap, obviously, in $1980.
They also killed the Mount Hood Freeway.
Yep, they killed that, and that was what emboldened the anti-car activists to kill everything else. You're exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately, the people use their cars, trucks need it, and we need more infrastructure for cars and trucks to get around.
Well, and it's a matter of personal freedom. It's personal liberty. The ability to move around and own an inexpensive vehicle to move yourself and your family wherever the heck you want to go, it's the ultimate personal liberty. And the idea that I'm going to take my family camping up on Mount Hood by using Max or, you know, doing something like that, it's absurd.
Yeah, or go to the Oregon coast, whatever. You know, and they've spent $5 billion, rough wag, on Max so far. And that's just not talking current dollars, but just the total dollars they've spent on all their lines now. You know, the next proposal, $2.5 to $3 billion for the light rail extension, you know, into Tiger Tualatin, and that's before cost overruns. You're looking at roughly $240, $250 million per mile.
Yep.
Generally speaking, a mile of freeway is about $10 million nationally. Holy mackerel. You could build 24 miles of freeway for every mile of Max light rail extension right there. Common sense says let's add the freeway lanes.
Yep. Yeah, my favorite story about the insanity of Portland and transportation is the construction of the tram up to OHSU. They originally budgeted something like $10 million, and they forgot to budget such things. I mean, there were cost overruns like steel prices spiked all of a sudden, but they also forgot to budget in architectural fees. So they ended up asking for like $55 billion, and it ended up being almost $70 billion by the time they were done. 70 million.
There you go. Yeah, exactly right. And sadly, typical government, oh, don't hold us accountable for our cost estimates. We just want the taxpayer, the property owner, to pony up a little bit more. And when you add the cost of that a little bit more over almost everything government does, it's horrendous.
Yep. Yep. All right. John Lee, thank you. Oh, my dog's going off.
The dog's saying, John, great interview.
That's right. That's right. So, John Lee, thanks so much for joining me. Where can people connect with you on social media?
Hey, I'm on Facebook, and I've got a website, johnlee.us.
Perfect. Thanks, John. I appreciate you joining me today.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Look forward to talking transportation in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
We'll see ya.
Thanks for checking out the Behind the Curtain podcast. I want to thank my buddy Brian Futch for providing me the theme song, I Am America, produced by Cass Anawati. Join us next Wednesday for another episode of Behind the Curtain with Jeff Reynolds.
Across the ocean, with nothing else but his dream for a better life. His folks over there shook their heads at such a crazy notion, but deep down in his heart, he knew he was right. Cleared the way for you and me. You can still hear his spirit sing. I am America. This land is my land, America. I know one day after I'm gone, someone will carry this dream along. And that's what makes this country so strong. I am America. Grandpa volunteered for the war across the ocean. There's no price for his country he wouldn't pay. Like so many others, he fought for the cause with great devotion. And just like his daddy, he led the way. Yeah, yeah, yeah. His stories have faded with his years, but his eyes say it loud and clear. Down the things he was taught, like loving your neighbor and trusting in God. I am America.